I call the Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Monday. Let's see, today must be the 21st. Monday, January 21st. Sorry, I had Friday written down here. It's Monday, January 21st. The time is 3:30. Today, the committee members present are Vice Chair Senator Fred Dyson, Senator Fairclough, Senator Bishop, Senator Machicki, and myself, Senator Giesel. Let's see, I don't see any other elected folks in the audience, but welcome to everyone. Excused absences today are Senator French and Senator McGuire. Operating our teleconference for us today is Sam Greeley, and our Senate Secretary is Ann Kretschelberg. So thanks very much for your help today. So today's agenda, the first item is to welcome again Commissioner Dan Sullivan. He's going to complete the introduction of his division directors and also wrap up the overview of the Department of Natural Resources. Then after that, the commissioner, along with Deputy Commissioner Balash and Senior Petroleum Geologist Mr. Paul Decker from the Division of Oil and Gas, will talk to us further about our topic of keeping the lights and heat on. So, welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks again for the opportunity to present here. As you mentioned, what I wanted to do, and this is just as much for the committee to get a sense of the leadership team, we just presented our House Resources overview, same presentation that we did with your committee on Friday. So what I do have that I didn't have on Friday is I have the leadership team at DNR. And what I'd like to do quickly, I know we went over there some of the responsibilities and accomplishments, but very simply wanted the committee to have a chance to have the different division directors stand up, say hi, and to my team, if you're not necessarily focused on Cook Inlet energy and opportunities, you should be free to go continue your other hard work throughout the state, but I really wanted to make sure the committee had the opportunity to see and hopefully at a later time meet with the leadership team here. So first, as I mentioned, and I won't go through what they have been doing, but I'll just give you an introduction to each of the members. The Division of Agriculture Director, Francie Hafmeister, if she's here, okay. Division of Forestry, Chris Mache, Director. Bob Swenson, our state geologist and head of the DGGS, who actually knows quite a lot about the topic. So, Bob, you don't get a pass to leave. You have to Mining, Land, and Water, Brent Goodrum, Director. Bill Barron, the director for the Division of Oil and Gas, is not here, but the deputy director, Joni Slemons, is here. Joni. Parks and Outdoor Recreation, Director Ben Ellis. Support Services, Gene Davis. The State Pipeline Coordinator's Office, Mike Thompson. And Tom Crawford, who is the director of OPUMP, our Office of Project Permitting. So that is the team, and as I mentioned last Friday, very proud to have this team working at DNR. I think they're great public servants, put in a lot of hours, and I know that they're probably going to be working very closely with members of this committee and the Senate throughout the legislative session. So appreciate the opportunity to have them come to this hearing, and as I mentioned to the team, we won't be insulted at all if you have other work to do that's not related to Cook Inlet challenges and opportunities. So, Madam Chair, I thought what we could do then is just go right into the presentation. Sorry, it probably took a little. We didn't get it to you sooner, but this is an opportunity for us that we know that there's been a lot of discussion on these issues. I want to start by saying, I certainly don't consider myself an expert. There's members of this committee, members sitting there, DNR employees sitting on both sides of me who know a heck of a lot more about this than I do. But I do think that it is important for this committee to get a sense of how DNR is thinking about it, how the state is thinking about it, And very importantly, and to be perfectly honest, we probably haven't done a good enough job on this topic, but to give you a sense of what we've been doing, too, not just the Department of Natural Resources, but kind of writ large, because I think it'll give you some idea that this has been, although North Slope Oil and Gas is often talked about, it was the main topic on Friday, this has been something that we've been very, very focused on. And there is challenges, certainly, but there's some good news in this as well. So without further ado, I'll just, with your permission, just start the presentation.
Great.
Okay. So that's the outline. And again, as we did Friday, we would welcome the opportunity to just have a conversation here when there are questions. And Joe Balash, Paul Decker, but also, in all seriousness, Bob Swenson, Joni Slemons are also very, very knowledgeable in this area. So if any of my team has insights or comments, we would welcome, if it's okay with you, to have them.
Absolutely. Yeah, that'd be great.
So, again, covering a fair amount of territory here. I won't go over each one, but what we thought would be important is just to kind of give a broader context to this and a little bit of background. Again, there's some people in this room that have a lot more knowledge on some of the background materials than I do, certainly. But so in terms of a broad overview and challenges, and you're going to see one of the things that we're going to talk about, there's been different studies, but as you can imagine from our perspective, we have kind of a broad view both of the basin and managing it and how and what the implications are with regard to taking certain actions, not only for the basin, but even for broader interests. We talked about the big gas line last week. We think a lot of these things are related in ensuring that this committee has an understanding of how we're thinking about them, we think is important, particularly kind of broad strategic interests of the state. But obviously, it's been an important, Cook Inlet has been an important a principal source of energy for the Anchorage and South Central region in terms of heating and electric power. It's also been a very important job producer, one of the cornerstones of at least that part of the state since statehood. And clearly, I think what your hearings have been focused on, it's a maturing oil and gas basin, and certainly there are legitimate concerns about contractual shortfalls. Your committee has already heard that. But we also want to emphasize there's still large volumes, we believe, of gas and oil to be discovered and developed in not maybe some of the huge fields that this basin has had before, but in intermediate size fields. The next point is that, you know, this basin is witnessing a transition, and that's very typical, and it's witnessing a transition in many ways from very large producers, Chevron, Marathon in the last couple years, to mid-size and small companies. I list some of the ones, but there's quite a number, Hillcorp, Apache, Nordac, and particularly the first two I mentioned there, they specialize in coming into declining basins, mature basins, bringing the capital, the technical expertise, to turning those basins around. So I'll get into that a little bit more, but we're happy that players like that are coming here, right? Marathon's a great company, Chevron's a great company, but to be honest, you know, I think they've been looking at the exit doors for a while. And as we mentioned here, we see this as a positive transition, but transitions can be slow. Transitions can increase certainty, and we, you know, this consent decree that took place over the course of the last few months with regard to the Marathon sale of assets to Hillcorp is a good example of uncertainty, froze up action, and so that's part of what we're looking at. And then, you know, there's the issue that I think you're very familiar, this committee is very familiar with, multiple stakeholders in the inlet. It's producers, it's utilities. You see the sub-bullet there. Kind of hard to find another spot in the U.S., might be wrong about this, where you have so many utilities for such a small population. That's not normally the case, and the rest of the country. I'm sure there are some examples that are similar to South Central, but probably not many. And regulators and the state and the feds, it is a lot of players. And as you can see here, that can represent some challenges moving forward. So when we talk about or when we think through strategic considerations, certainly we think there's widespread agreement. Number one strategic consideration with regard to this part of the state is energy security for Alaskans, keeping lights and power on. The other one that kind of draws on the previous slide is the importance of the different stakeholders working together. Sometimes they have different interests. You have contracts, you have the state involvement, as I mentioned. They're complex problems in the inlet, but one of the things you're going to see from our perspective is we have been, from the governor on down, trying to do it more and more, certainly in the last several months, playing much more of a convener role, right? There's certain authorities that DNR and the state have in this inlet. I'll get into them. They're very clear. We've been driving on those hard. But there's some that are less kind of obvious. They're not really authorities. They're just roles that trying to bring the different stakeholders together to work through these problems is something that we think is critical, and we've been trying to take on some of that responsibility. The isolated nature of power generation in Alaska obviously is something that we're all, I think, acutely aware of. And then this, again, is kind of a different perspective that we, and I think you, the legislature, bring to the table here, which is the importance of addressing immediate concerns, but also ensuring that we think through long-term implications of actions. Some of the actions here are just private sector utilities, producers. We don't have much of a role, if any, I don't think. But there are things that, whether it relates to more Cook Inlet production, clearly in everybody's interest, more jobs in the inlet, clearly in everybody's interest, and even broader strategic interests like expediting the big gas line, whether it's the APP project, AGDC, or a combination of both. All of those are strategic goals, and we don't want shorter-term actions undermining those issues. And that's something we keep an eye on, and we think it's important to highlight those. So those are some strategic considerations, probably not very insightful, but it is how we are thinking through a lot of the more details that we want to lay out to this committee. A little bit of a development history. Again, there are a lot more people who are experts on this that know these issues better than I do. But you do have this issue of finding a resource, finding volumes that are way bigger than what the market needs at the time, and having the ability to have commercial interest in that market because there are other outlets, whether it's an agri plant, whether it's export abilities. And you see here, and we talked about it on Friday, this is the pioneer in the world in terms of LNG exports to Asia, and a record that is second to none. So a little bit of the development history, and you look at some of the oil and gas production that was originally discovered that's still ongoing. So if Cook Inlet weren't the older but little brother of the North Slope, this would, you know, be considered quite a significant basin, and we certainly consider it one. Okay, so that's kind of an overview, and again, what we wanted to do now, and this is where the experts really kind of take to the table, is have Paul, who literally is one of the best, has got a great resume, private sector experience, great public servant, who's been working on these issues for a lot, to provide an overview of kind of how we're looking at some of these issues, how it compares to the PRA study that came out, which we think is a strong study, but we're kind of taking a broader look at some of these issues, and really, really important terminology that as policymakers consider some of the implications of what's happening in the inlet, to be able to discern between committed volumes, resources, reserves, deliverability, things that in this complex system really matter, and so we wanted to cover a lot of that in the next part. Paul.
Thank you. So for the record, my name is Paul Decker. I'm a petroleum geologist with the Division of Oil and Gas, where I currently manage the resource evaluation section. So this first slide here on the resources is just a nod to what some of you, I'm sure, have heard of, the U.S. Geological Survey's estimates from about a year and a half ago, where they did a resource assessment of all the undiscovered, technically recoverable oil and gas thought to be left in the basin here in Cook Inlet. So think, ponder on those words, just take careful note, undiscovered and technically recoverable. So what they come up with seem like very large numbers, even their mean numbers here. 19 trillion cubic feet of natural gas and about 650.
That's the mean number.
The mean number, right. And about 650 million barrels of oil plus natural gas liquids. So these are really quite large numbers. And I just wanted to skip a bullet here and say that, first of all these USGS resource assessments are probabilistic in nature, meaning they're statistical. We don't really know what's down there, so the best we can do is to make our best guess, which is kind of the mean, roughly speaking, and then a low-end estimate and a much higher high-end estimate. So again, this is just sort of a mid-range best estimate here that we're presenting, but there are wide, wide sidebars on that. Now, the other point, as the commissioner just nodded to, the terms can be confusing in what we're going to talk about here. I already pointed out the difference between undiscovered and discovered. These are undiscovered estimates so far. Also, the difference between resources and reserves, we really have to draw a sharp line there. We'll define those here a few slides from now. And then the whole concept of getting gas under contract, that's even yet a different sort of subset of the entirety of the gas resource. So, and then there's another term that we allude to here, peak deliverability, if we can advance the slides. Peak deliverability is a concept that's really, really germane to this this question of keeping the lights on in Cook Inlet and the heat running. We, as I will show at the DNR, have done a significant amount of study, and we believe that there's actually considerable volumes of gas at different levels of certainty left in the basin. Certainly enough to meet, we believe, to meet the average annual demand for a number of years. But now, how long can we meet the peak deliverability? You know, on the coldest days of January or February, demand spikes, and that's what this this figure that you see in front of you here, I believe it's slide number 9, represents. If you just stand back and look at it, you see this sort of sine wave of seasonal variation between summer and winter, much lower in the summer, much higher in the winter, and then on the coldest days of winter, it's much higher still. So that is a very tricky problem, and I just want to acknowledge that as a serious issue, but not one that our studies at the Division of Oil and Gas have been primarily able to reconcile. Okay, so the issue of peak deliverability is a bit of a sticky point that has not really been fully addressed. But if we can move on to the next slide.
Excuse me, Mr. Decker. Senator Machiki had a question.
Yeah, through the chair, please. Mr. Decker, an important metric is peak-peak. I was just wondering what your department is using for a peak-peak number these days for Cook Inlet.
Through the chair, Senator Machiki, I'm not sure what that number is. If we are using such a number, so to speak, I'm not sure that we have a number set out for that. I can ask around and find out. Okay. So it's not a number that I'm...
My understanding through the chair, again, is we... This 410 average and what could cause rolling blackouts is not being able to meet peak days, which I understand is around 5.5 right now, 550 million standard cubic feet a day. I was just wondering if the department was looking at that number as well.
As I said, our studies have not really focused on the peak deliverability issue, as I hope to show you what our study did was really try and estimate the quantities of resource and reserves in the basin and draw the distinctions between those. So it's certainly an important question, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, but one thing we will get to it is that in the actions that we've been focusing on, again, there's an issue of where we are directly kind of working on issues that are most consistent with what we're able to do under statutes and responsibilities, and I'll get into that, leases, units, encouraging production, but in areas that are still very important, particularly to try and address this, you'll see throughout this presentation that we have also worked with the different stakeholders on the issue of storage, which has been in some ways one of the most important ways, not the only way, but one of the most important ways to try and address some of these peak issues.
Sure. Thank you.
Next slide, please. Okay, so moving on, slide 10. This is a question or a slide to make the point that the different entities involved in this issue have different perspectives. So beginning with the DNR and the Division of Oil and Gas, our primary concern is managing the gas resource, and that's the resource in its entirety, meaning the undiscovered resource, at least understanding what the undiscovered resource is, such as the USGS has done, understanding the discovered, still non-producing resources, as well as the producing reserves. And so we have sort of a broad base of knowledge that we need to maintain. The utilities, on the other hand, have what I would call a laser focus on just getting gas under contract. That's really all that matters to them, and they're very forthright in letting us know that, that's really a very specific concern of theirs, gas under contract. The producers, they have a different view of it themselves, I'm sure. They're most focused on delivering the contracted gas in the most efficient way possible. And so there gets to be a bit of a chicken and egg issue here in terms of when the supply is available. Well, they don't want to supply it any sooner than than the contracts are in place to produce to and so forth. But looking back up to the upper right there, the Division of Oil and Gas where I work, we estimate the Cook Inlet gas several different ways. Since we have to understand the entirety of the resource, we've incorporated what's called decline curve analysis, material balance analysis, and geologic volumetric analyses. And I'll explain what those are as we work through that. But we've sort of taken both a couple of different engineering approaches that are very standardized approaches and a time-tested geologic approach as well, and done all of those to understand the entirety of the resource. On the other hand, PRA, the agency or the consulting group that has worked for the utilities, they've drawn their analysis based on decline curves alone. So it's just a different focus that's more appropriate to their interest in, you know, how much gas is available to contract. Again, we have a different view of the basin with our responsibility at the DNR. So if we move on here, this is just the front page of the PRA study. They've done studies in 2009, updated them in 2010 and 2012. We feel that it's a good solid product, a good analysis of what they were trying to accomplish, which is that highly certain amount of gas available to get under contract. I believe when Mr. Stokes presented this the other day, he described it as based really specifically on decline curve analysis. And what that is a commonplace engineering techniques that examines the historical gas production and extrapolates forward, particularly usually from the most recent set of data, the historical production over the last few years, and projects that into the future to forecast how the production rates are going to decline. Okay, and inherent in that is really that you can only base it on the past production. So decline analysis by itself really assumes that no further drilling or new fields are coming online or that no real redevelopment work is going on in the existing fields. If we're going to try and do that, you're going to get into much more speculative realms. But they've done it just based on historical production. And based on their findings, they predict a gas supply shortfall in the next year or 2 years, probably next year, and that the supply shortfall, the delta there, will increase year on year after that. This is a real concern. We don't have any disagreement with that. I just want to explain that our study took a different tack. First, let's go to the next slide. And this is really straight out of the PRA report, and I believe Mr. Stokes showed this to you all last week, that it relies on the decline curve analysis, and that was also the first step in the DNR's analysis. And so what we're looking at here is a comparison of the decline analysis from their report versus ours in 2009. And, you know, you can quibble over some small differences, but the point is two independent groups working this out based on historical production data come up with very similar answers, very, very similar decline profiles. Where we differed in our approach at DNR was that we went on to augment this analysis with another engineering technique, the material balance analysis, and then we went on to the geologic volumetric analysis beyond that. And what we found is that from material balance analyses, we found about one-third more gas that we would categorize as reserves, fairly certain volumes of gas, in the existing fields and throughout the basin, than you would see doing strictly decline analysis by itself. So about a third more, that's a significant increase. And then the geologic volumetrics beyond that that I'll describe, they map out significant additional volumes beyond what the material balance saw. So we draw from that this simple conclusion that the basin still has significant additional possible reserve potential. Some of that's in reserves, some of it's in resources, and we'll define what that is here next. Just another point is that the state really has somewhat limited information. Contrary to what you may have heard, we are not receiving reserve reports from the industry, the operators themselves, nor do we have complete information necessarily on all the wells drilled on either native or federal lands in Cook Inlet. We may or may not have all that information. And for some of the fields, for example, the biggest gas field, Kenai River Field, we just really don't have the data.
Excuse me, Mr. Decker. Senator Faircloth had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the reserves, are we checking the financials then to use reserve data that are declared publicly, or how are we estimating the reserves that individual companies have in the Alaska or Cook Inlet Basin specifically?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, to my knowledge, my division is not specifically auditing the reserves that the companies report to the SEC, and they don't report those reserves on a field scale in any case.
Is there global?
Right. They do a roll-up. Typically, they might do it at the Alaska scale or more likely at the North America scale, that sort of roll-up scales.
I would think we might have access to some rolled up, at least in Alaska, not all roll-up national.
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, one of the things that we have been doing, and it's and you'll see it here again, particularly kind of in the last several months, is sitting down with pretty much everybody in the inlet, producers, explorers, and getting a much better sense. They're not always required to provide that. Some of it, in some ways, is depending on how they want to characterize the conversation, they can ask for confidentiality. But we have been trying to get to more specifics on exactly what we're seeing with regard to mostly some of the exploration activity, which, as you know, is kind of in transition. But as we'll get to here, it is one of the good news stories that's going on because there's a lot of it.
Any other questions, committee members? All right. Oh, yes. Sorry, Mr. Balash.
If I may, for the record, Joe Balash, Deputy Commissioner at DNR. With the recent FTC inquiry surrounding the Marathon asset acquisition by Hillcorp, a subpoena was issued for every player in the inlet. And the Department of Law, in all likelihood, has access to all of the very specific information that we do not. But they were given that information for a purpose and in a context that we're not able to reach in and look at, unfortunately. But, you know, that may be another avenue for consideration if it becomes necessary.
Senator Dyson or no. Senator Fairclough, did you follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just know that we're trying to attract exploration into the basin everywhere. And as smaller companies are entering into the market, their financials are, let's say, more transparent than larger international companies. And so they need reserves banked on their bottom line to go out and bond or raise capital. So there is a spot where we can go look at reserves that should be publicly available to us to see what we can anticipate at least out in a decade, not necessarily in short term. So
yeah,
I'm glad we're doing that.
If we could have the next slide, please. Okay, so moving on to really define a couple of terms here, the material balance analysis, what is that? It's, again, it's a standardized engineering approach to estimating the gas in place and therefore the gas recoverable from a reservoir. And the way we do that is to look at the change in reservoir pressure over time. Think of a pinhole leak in a tire, you know, the air coming out of it, the pressure is going to decrease. And based on the rate of that decrease over time, you can predict how much air was in the tire. So it's a standardized technique, and as I mentioned earlier, using that in addition to the decline curve analysis allowed DNR to, with a high degree of confidence, be able to say that there was about 30%, 32% more gas than you see just from the decline analysis itself. That gas may be in parts of the reservoir that are in pressure communication but not necessarily producing through the active completions. And it's important to remember that the reserve estimates that are being quoted by the utilities and their consultants really do not incorporate that kind of analysis. So, again, that's appropriate because they were interested in contracting reserves.
Sure. Senator Machiki had a question.
Oh, I happen to be one of those guys that likes to remind us that we're communicating to the general public in Alaska that may not understand some of our terms. I think what you're saying is that 32% more gas reserves may exist. However, you're not putting the economic feasibility into that possibility. You're saying they're there, but whether or not they're recoverable by what we would apply today for a feasible field, you're not making a judgment call on that as well, right?
Through the chair, Senator Machiki, I'll show you here toward the end of the slides that I'll be showing, just a few slides from now, where we believe the material balance identified reserves would sit with respect to commerciality. And we do think that they should be commercial, actually. So I'll show you that in a moment.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Okay. In addition to the material balance analysis, we went on to do geologic volumetric analysis. And really what that involves is looking at all the well logs, all the penetrations of the gas fields, and picking each and every potentially gas-bearing sand and asking ourselves, would that produce or would it not? You know, does it make the producible thresholds? What evidence do we have that it would or would not produce? And we assigned it, therefore, to either a pretty high certainty pay category or a potential pay category or a non-pay category. And so then when you take all those observations of each and every sand and you map them up in three dimensions and work out their pore volume, their saturations, and so forth, you can figure out how much gas is there and how much you should expect to be able to recover from that. So when we do that, we see that these fields contain more geologically identified gas than either the decline analysis or the material balance analysis would identify. So again, it's this idea that the geology just identifies yet another wedge of, or a couple of different wedges at different levels of certainty of gas in these reservoirs. And you're not going to see those from the engineering methods that rely strictly on production to extrapolate the volumes. So that's the virtue of the geologic analysis. Okay, moving on to the next slide. The fact that PRA's report predicts a shortfall in gas production under contract within the next few years is, we guarantee it, is a cause for concern. However, it really should not be construed to mean that the Cook Inlet resource has been depleted, that the gas resources are depleted in the basin. Not at all. Rather, it reflects the fact that not enough new wells are coming online fast enough to keep pace with that decline. So, because the Cook Inlet is isolated from the greater North American spot market, there's always going to be a tension there between oversupply and undersupply, a tension there, the amount of gas available for delivery at any given moment. It's really going to be a function of sales contracts. Producers have no economic incentive to drill for gas before they can actually get it under contract, begin to recoup their investment. It's not as if they have a year-round spot market to sell into.
Senator Dyson, a question? Yeah,
thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, as I look at the what you call a sine wave chart there, it looks like the summer times it's 250, something like that. And so they can produce more gas than they can sell during that period. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, historically anyway, that has been very true. They could produce more than they could sell, so they would take steps to throttle back production on key wells and then just have certain wells that they could turn on to meet swing production in the winter.
And tell me how our reservoir where we're trying to store gas, how that fits into that part demand fluctuation.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, the CINGSA storage and other gas storage projects in Cook Inlet are, in my mind, some of the key components to solving our dilemma here. Maybe not by itself, but certainly over the long run, if you have enough storage to sell into, then this seasonal demand issue is not going to well, what it does is takes out the need to have gas under contract to actually give you the economic incentive to drill. If you have a storage facility to sell into year-round, there you have a market right there. You don't need to worry about gas under contract. So so in my mind, it's an incredibly important part of evening out not just the swings in production, but also evening out the demand,
And
for the producers. I'm sorry?
And the return to the drillers. The
Absolutely. Producers.
Yeah. So, if I may, on a year-round, what's the average, if you average the winter and the summer, 350?
Let's see. Per day, I don't know exactly what it is per day. I think it's about 90 BCF per year. Is that around 250 million a day? Yeah, 260. Through the chair.
Yeah, and if I may, so I worry that they can't make money and make enough return on investment to keep poking more holes in the ground. And, you know, just hear that some of them, because of the delta on oil price, you know, they're more interested in drilling where there's going to be more oil and going back to the old paradigm of just getting associated gas and so on. And we, of course, have a public interest in the gas. That so how do we incentivize them more to keep going after the gas when there's no market for it on an annual basis? I realize it's a little beyond your job description, but
if I may, through the chair, Senator Dyson, you're touching on something that's absolutely critical to this whole question, and that is access to market. If you have no place to sell your gas, why would you drill for it in the first place? Why would you undertake the expense and risk and uncertainty associated with that? And so one of the things that we touch on here through the presentation a little bit later is that question fundamentally. How do you ensure that the market is available to folks who want to undertake exploration activity and, importantly, provide a sufficiently attractive return that they will undertake that activity? So when you think about the market, what we're talking about right now is a relatively small and highly volatile market. And as the big anchors that used to be present in the inlet in terms of an outlet, be it Agrium, fertilizer plant, or an export facility, as those things fall away and are no longer available, that causes problems for us, for our explorers and interests in exploration. So you're hitting on something that's critical to understanding the dilemmas here and what may ultimately be part of the solution.
May I follow up?
Mr. Jason?
So my uninformed perspective is, you know, half a dozen years ago, part of the problem was the RCA, you know, far more focused on keeping prices down for the consumer rather than the investment that would keep the field up and producing what we need for a long time. Now, largely, I think that issue has gone away. But is there market forces that would say even we consumers ought to be paying a bit more to make it give the incentive for the producers?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, you're kind of skipping ahead on me.
Okay.
with all due respect. But you touched on an issue that we will raise later on, and that's the actions around APL5 and the consequences of the decisions that were made by the commission about 8 years ago. And you're right, some of those decisions and decision-making processes have changed for the better. Unfortunately, we lost some momentum in the market and the planning and the activities that were going on at the time. And there were knock-on effects for the export facility as well as the fertilizer plant that, you know, is quite unfortunate and is probably going to cost us all a little bit more to regain the momentum necessary.
Thank you.
So through the chair, Senator Dyson, we have a bullet towards the end that talks about learning from history, right, and what we're trying to do that, and Joe's hitting on it. And the two questions you've asked are exactly some of the broader policy issues that we've been looking at that we think are very important for this committee to be aware of that might not be the immediate focus of some of the other people that have been testifying in front of this committee. And that's, again, where we think who's in front of you, sometimes it depends on what the perspective is in terms of what their most immediate interests are. And that's not saying that's good or bad. It's just saying sometimes where you sit is reflective of what you see.
Shocked.
Any other questions, committee members? I have a question for you, Mr. Decker. A common thing that I get asked is, well, why can't the producer simply turn off the well during the summer and turn it back on during the winter? Could you briefly explain why that doesn't happen?
Yes, Madam Chair. I am just a geologist. I'm not a reservoir engineer, so if only my boss Bill were here, Bill Barron. But my understanding is that one of the issues there is that without the gas flowing through the tubing to the surface all the time, some of the entrained water can actually infiltrate the well and just sort of sit there, right, without the force of the gas to blow that water out of the hole. Or reservoir fluids could migrate in to the perforations that allow the gas to flow into the well from the adjoining reservoir. And if that happens, if that's sort of statically soaking the reservoir, you can really damage the framework of the sandstone. It has sometimes water-sensitive clays that can swell up. So basically, it's like clogging up the sponge that's holding the gas, not to mention just literally filling up the tubing with water if it's not being flushed out. So you can result in significant damage to the well that may or may not be repairable, depending on the completion and what access the remediation engineers would have to the formation.
Great explanation. Your director has explained it to me, and you summarized that really well. That was great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead and proceed.
Okay, so just a couple more points on this slide, just to remind you of the upper right there about the USGS assessments. You know, there's the USGS, they're intelligent people. They have large estimates for the basin. We think that that means something. But really, almost more importantly, is the hundreds of millions of dollars that companies are pouring into the basin. They're voting with their pocketbooks here and saying that Cook Inlet has significant amounts of gas potential left. That means a lot to us. And so clearly, new gas production is going to be needed from a combination of exploration drilling, bringing new fields online, as well as infill and reinvestment, various kinds of reinvestment in our existing fields. Now, if we turn the page here to this very colorful slide, what this is one of the summaries that came out of our 2009 study. It is a schematic forecast or a hypothetical forecast looking forward from that time, the end of 2009. It is not intended to be our best prediction of what was actually going to occur. What this was to represent is, as you see up there in the upper part of the graph in red, this assumes substantial investment in redevelopment activity in the existing fields, plus or minus some exploration success. But it really doesn't include wildcat drilling, new prospects, new parts of the basin where discoveries could bring new gas online. So this was really focused on the producing gas fields and specifically three or four of those main fields where we had enough geologic data to take a detailed look at the geologic volumetrics in some of those larger fields. So what you're seeing there in the different colors are the amounts of gas that we at the DNR were able to identify left in the reservoirs by these different approaches, the red being the most certain, the decline curve analysis, the orange being slightly less certain, material balance analysis, but still an engineering thing that is based on historical production and pressures. And then the green wedge and the yellow wedge represent the high confidence pay that we established from geologic volumetrics and the less certain 50% risk potential pay in yellow. And so that big block of yellow has actually already been cut in half from what we calculated. You know, when we went and did all of our well log correlations and interpretations and mapped out the volume of potential pay, it was twice the volume that you see there. So we discounted it by 50% in the knowledge that it's really kind of getting out there and being pretty interpretive. So what you see here is already somewhat risked. But in any case, if we go to the next slide, you'll see how those different volumes line up in terms of certainty. Here we have a matrix that's adapted from the Society of Petroleum Engineers, part of an effort really of various societies and agencies worldwide to standardize the reserves and resource nomenclature. They've come up with this this diagram. And so let's start at the bottom. The bottom tier represents undiscovered resources. This is what the USGS assessment is all about. So the crystal ball gazing and asking ourselves, how much gas could there possibly be in the basin? So that would be undiscovered. The companies with prospects that they'd like to drill, those volumes that they think might be in the prospects, would be in that category. Now, once they've drilled a well and made a discovery, there's some time lag there, usually before they know whether it's going to be commercial and whether they have, board of directors sanctioned to develop that. But during that period, once it's discovered, it would go into that middle tier called contingent resources. And an important thing to keep in mind is that each tier of this diagram, we have a low ball estimate on the left, a higher end estimate on the right, and sort of a best estimate somewhere in the middle. So then once it's established to be commercial, that you're going to go ahead and develop this gas field or these reserves, that's when they're properly called reserves. I just misspoke. Up until that point, they weren't reserves. They were resources. Once they're known to be commercial, then they slide into this top tier. And like I said there, there's a lowball estimate of proved at the far left in the red. That's what we can see from decline curve analysis. There's a best estimate, what we can see, they call it probable or 2P reserves. That's decline plus material balance estimates. And then the geologic volumetrics, some of those are going to be in this 3P possible reserves. Certainly, some of that's going to be commercial. Some of it we don't know yet if it's commercial or not. So it's split. The yellow and green are split between the commercial and the contingent resource categories. So I hope that's helpful. I really probably should have started off with those two definitions at the right. And I've used these terms all through the presentation. I apologize for not defining them until this point. But the difference between resources and reserves, really a key point. Reserves are oil and gas volumes that are confirmed by drilling, and we're either certain or highly convinced that they're going to be economically producible. So they have to be discovered and economic to be considered reserves. Up to that point, they're just resources. Resources is a much broader term. It includes, what you haven't actually found yet by the drill bit. It also includes those volumes that are discovered but not yet demonstrated to be commercial. So apologize for the lag in getting to those definitions there. And if we turn the page one last time here for me, it's just to let you know that since PRA has updated their study in 2012, we at DNR have also sort of taken our previous studies, taken a hard look at them and updated them, dusted them off, so to speak. And at this point, in the 28 fields that we've analyzed, we feel there's a estimated 1.1 trillion cubic feet of estimated reserves that's producible in those fields. So remaining producible reserves of over a trillion cubic feet, that's from both decline curve analysis and material balance analysis. In addition to that, we think we have about 355 billion cubic feet of undeveloped gas resources in three primary fields, and that would be from the geologic volumetric analysis, the overage between the geologic and the engineering approach. And so you see here that that's split mainly between three fields, the Beluga River unit with about 230 BCF, Trading Bay unit, Grayling Gas Sands with around 70, and the North Cook Inlet unit with about 50 BCF. And it's worth noting that, we took a look at the recent drilling that's been done in those fields, and sure enough, they've been putting in additional wells since we did our study, tapping, in some cases, new compartments of the reservoir that were at virgin reservoir pressures that had not yet been depleted at all, and with the respectable flow rates on the order of 1 to 7 million cubic feet per day for the 8 to 10 wells that we had in these fields. Not to say that all of the wells are successful. Some are not commercial or not successful, but a high rate of commercial success so far. So that's where I'd like to leave it and turn it back over to Commissioner Sullivan, unless you have further questions.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, I think the Paul, as you can see, does an amazing job, the whole team does, but I think the main point that he made earlier is that gas that's not contracted gas is not the same as a depleted reservoir. And I think that gets mixed up in a lot of the reporting. I think when you read the newspaper articles and stuff about the challenges in Cook Inlet, people assume that we're out of gas. We're not out of gas. So what we have been focused on is what is needed is more wells, more investment, and to try and pull on other levers that can help with the overall security of supply in the inlet. So what I wanted to do here is kind of give the committee an update on those actions. And I think, one of the things that I've learned through this process is that certainly in the last couple of years we've been very focused on this, and I think we'll give you a sense of that with some of the upcoming slides. But we haven't done a very good job of talking about it, and we probably could do a better job of giving you a sense of some of the different things that we have been working on, because some are starting to produce some positive results. So what the next couple slides does is it just gives a sense of those areas. And as you can see here, the main area of our focus was in the main areas where DNR, at least from the state's perspective, has authority to best advance the state's interest. And there are other areas where we're kind of, it's not the normal thing that we do, but we've also been engaging in those areas. So if you look at the right side of this slide, the thing that we've really been trying to do, which is obviously right up the responsibility of the land manager, is to get out, market the resource potential, aggressively market the leases, aggressively make people aware of what the legislature passed in 2010, which we think is having a positive, very positive effect, and then go directly to certain potential investors. So, you know, we'll touch on it. There's a broad diversity of players in the inlet, but when we caught wind early on, this is 2 years ago now, that the possibility of Hillcorp and Apache being interested in Cook Inlet, we set off to Houston. We briefed them at the CEO level. We briefed them at the technical level. And we were very focused on trying to get them and other companies to get up here and to drill and to invest. And particularly companies like this that have a proven record of going into mature basins and turning them around, that have a proven record of spending significant amounts of capital in doing that, and that have a proven record of the technical expertise to operate in a basin like this, that Paul, Bob Swenson, others are the experts, but this is a complicated basin. And so that was certainly one and probably the principal area of our efforts to try to address what Paul was talking about. It's not what we believe is a lack of hydrocarbons, neither does USGS, by the way. It's a lack of more investment, capital, and wells being drilled. And again, Chevron and Marathon are great companies, but they had been signaling for a long time that they're not really that interested in Cook Inlet anymore. And so this transition of getting the new crop of players here has been an area of focus, and as we'll get into some slides coming up, we think it's going pretty well. The other thing that we've been doing, and Bill Barron has been really the lead in this, is looking at the ability to use unit applications and even lease terms, which is new for us. And this was also Kevin Banks. He did a good job on this, to encourage more drilling. And we've been doing that on the North Slope, but we've been doing that particularly in Cook Inlet. And that's a bit of a balance, because if you drive too hard a bargain, you just lose people. But we have been saying, nope, you're not going to get a unit until you drill here, drill here, drill here. And so we've used that leverage that's obviously based in statute to get more more drilling going. Other areas that they're not directly so as you can imagine, those two areas are exactly where you would expect DNR to be working this hard. And from our perspective, certainly the most important. But there's a whole host of other areas that we think are important that we wanted the committee to be aware of. Ensuring this issue that we talked about Friday, the streamlined permitting so that projects can move forward in a timely manner. This is one area, to be perfectly frank, where the federal government has not been terribly helpful. There's been some delays, important delays in Cook Inlet that have been the permitting delays on the federal side, and that's an issue for all of us. It's an issue that in some ways bedevils development throughout the state, but in Cook Inlet, we see it, and it's frustrating. We've intervened. The AG intervened in lawsuits that relate to getting projects moving forward in the inlet. And we've tried to make, and I'll talk about a little bit more, to make the RCA process a little less uncertain. Bob Swenson and his team have been doing a lot, and this is really important, to gather and publish and get out the expertise on the new geological information, including very specific briefings with potential
companies that are interested in Cook Inlet and the North Slope. And then we talked about it, but the regulatory side, both at DNR and in the Department of Law, to move that Singsa storage facility forward was something that, again, didn't get a lot of press, but you may recall about 2 years ago, there was an RCA decision that looked like it was going to completely stall that. We asked for a reconsideration. We asked them to expedite it. They did. And then we put that through our O-pump permitting process and really, really tried to expedite the storage because, as everybody's been talking about here, it's so important, and it is already having an important effect. And one of the things that, you know, we've talked to NSTAR and others possibly about is looking at ways to expand that storage capability. And that is another kind of area of energy security for the inlet. Importantly, at the Department of Law, we've reoriented the RAPA outlook. Senator Dyson, you referenced it. The legislature did this with regard to RCA. But having the public interest defined in terms of price and security of supply. Previously, that part of the Attorney General's office seemed very focused on just the price. And as we're going to explain a little bit later, you know, at the end of the day, that can have the consequences of undermining both price and security of supply in the long term. And to be honest, I think we're seeing a little bit of that. As Joe mentioned, we've lost some momentum. But if you look at RAPA filings in the last couple of years, they define the public interest in a way that brings both of those issues to the fore, not just defining public interest solely with regard to price.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I looked through the packet to see if you weren't ahead of me on something. I'm told by geologists that the attractive formations for oil and gas production extend out under the Moose Range on the federal lands. And I wrote to your former boss, George Bush, here 5.5 years ago, and I said, you can't get any more unpopular. Why don't you demand that those guys let us get out there and explore? And I referenced the national interest. We all at least know where the stuff is at, you know, if push gets to shove. And some folks said, you know, the first thing we need to do is get out there and fly 3D seismic and then poke some holes in the ground to get a verification that of what we're seeing out there. Now, I understand some of the 3D seismic has been going on out there and that there's been some drilling, I think, mostly on native inholdings. Can you tell us or me what's going on with both? And do you, from your former job, have any idea what we could do to get permission to get out there? I spent a lot of time out there in the Moose Range, and it's low-quality environment. I even offered to George, your former boss, that we might trade him Chick-Chick Lakes, which I don't think there's any minerals underneath, much higher quality. But anyway.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, Joe Balash here. With regard to exploration activities in and around the Moose Range, in the spring of 2011, a Siri lessee, NORDAC, was able to punch an ice road in and drill an exploration well, that the results of which gave the company enough confidence to sanction a development project that is currently in a NEPA review and looks like they are on track for a record of decision a little bit later this late winter, early spring, right about the time we hit breakup. And so they'll need to wait for things to dry out a little bit before they actually complete the road into a location where they'll be able to construct a pad and move forward with additional drilling and testing that is a very important part to being able to move from the discovered resource category into the bookable reserve category that would allow them to enter into contracts with utilities. So that's something that we can expect this year. As long as the Fish and Wildlife Service stays on track. With regard to the 3D seismic program you referenced, another operator, Apache, has been attempting to undertake a basin-wide survey. And my understanding is that they have gotten less than helpful responses from the service that manages the refuge and have not been able to place their nodes on any of the inland boundaries, even that are in the transition zone associated with the edge of the water. So,
which are the nodes, which are about the size of coffee cans.
So there is a tremendous amount of frustration with the managers in the refuge there in particular, because it seems to be a little bit of a double standard. When the refuge wanted to build a new visitor facility and parking lot for itself, didn't seem to have a problem with looking at the impacts and getting the authorizations in place. But that's maybe another story for another day. More broadly, another federal agency that has proven to be maybe not as difficult, but certainly challenging from a timing standpoint and timeliness review is the National Marine Fisheries Service. Again, going back to Apache's basin-wide survey program, they were on track to really ramp up their activities this winter, but had to, this was for Apache, but because they were not able to get the biological opinion necessary for some of the ESA compliance reviews and authorizations, they've had to push things off. And as I understand it, we have got NMFS back on a track to complete things, but you know it's causing a kink in the overall plan, and that ultimately is a delay. So I tried to cover the issues you raised there in your question. I hope I did.
Just a quick follow-up, if I may.
Yes,
Mr. Sullivan, putting on an old hat. Let's say that we get the 3D seismic and it looks very attractive, and the holes we drill in the ground give us some ground truth to see, you know, to verify what we think we're seeing. What could we do as a state to get sweeten the deal so the feds would let us get out there in a very responsible way and start producing the gas?
Well, through the chair, Senator Dyson, you know, in my experience, having worked for the federal government, it's not a monolith, right? So there's agencies that we work well with, other agencies that we haven't worked so well with have other kind of areas of focus. And we have been letting senior Department of Interior officials know about these problems that Joe talked about. And, you know, I think part of it is just the education. Particularly given the issue of the needs of energy for Alaskans, making the case, we'll continue to press that. But like I said, in some ways it depends on the agency, right? And if it's Department of Energy or the National Security, there's other agencies that I think are going to be more sympathetic to Alaskans trying to get energy for their own use in situations where we don't have a lot of redundant capacity with other regions of the country, essentially none. And but right now, some of the ones that we've been dealing with that have the authority, it's been, as I mentioned earlier, it's been a frustration. It's not all bad, right? Even the NMFS thing, they're trying to get back on schedule, and we're hopeful. They've been coming to our OPUMP meetings. Apache's now permitting through OPUMP, but it's just an ongoing frustration, and to be honest, we don't have the time, right? We don't have another year to wait. We got to get on this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michiki.
Commissioner, I appreciate your optimism. Part of this process that's very important is educating the public about where we really are. The my understanding of the shortness of supply in Cookie Inlet is that it's been predicted for 20 years. It's right on schedule. You're seeing all the classic signs of increased costs for ratepayers. I'm unaware of any volumes of gas that are having trouble finding a contract. We've got a supply issue, and the public needs to understand that. My only request is that the department continues to look for a parallel path. It would be very nice if the industry can provide in Cook Inlet, and we're all supportive of that. However, if the decline rate continues, we need to be on a parallel path of looking for a source of energy to protect the nearly 500,000 ratepayers that are depending on electricity and home heating in South Central Alaska.
Through the chair, Senator, we're going to touch on that here too. So it's a point very well taken, right? We're not saying this is it. This is all we're focused on. But again, you start to get a little bit out of the realm of producers sitting down with utilities on issues or some of the other things that we'll talk about, where some of the areas, at least on the state side, of the direct authority over some of those activities isn't as clear as where we've been focusing here. And I think you have a sense of what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So just a couple other points on some of the things that we've been focused on. And again, it's really looking at all the different elements. It starts to go into your point, Senator Machicki, on looking at non-gas power generation online. So that's Eva Creek. Further down the line, that's Healy, UCG, possibly hydro. But then this is something, again, where it goes this issue of, it's not necessarily in the, when you look at the statute on what DNR, other state agencies are working on, but we have been spending a lot of time on these other issues because we think they're very important in terms of helping to advance transactions and expediting them that we think are in the state's interest. So whether that's the Chevron Hillcorp deal, very importantly, this FTC, which is those of you who have talked to producers, right? The Federal Trade Commission went and had a big investigation on this next acquisition, the Marathon Hillcorp acquisition. We saw that as strongly in the state's strategic interest for the reasons I mentioned. You have a company that seems, and we'll see, but certainly seems highly motivated to come in, spend money, and try to turn around the basin versus, again, Marathon's a great company. We certainly would welcome them to put more money in the inlet, or importantly, money on the North Slope, right? Investment. We have had frequent meetings with them about that. But from the state's perspective, we thought this going through was really important. And at a certain point, it looked like the FTC didn't share that view. So that took a lot of testifying in front of the FTC. As you probably know, every player in the entire basin was hit with subpoenas. That took a lot, talk about momentum. A lot of people had to focus on that, including the Attorney General. They had a consent decree through that we think ultimately was in the state's interest, but that took a lot of time. And that's another area where we've been focused. And then, as I mentioned, a much broader area that we've been trying to play a role the last several months of bringing the different parties together, try to problem solve. There were some storage issues relating to some of the parties this fall. We quietly played a very active role in trying to address those. And this element is also really important to kind of go to what you were talking about, to get some good ideas on trying to address some of these immediate term issues, which is one of the things that we wanted to end the presentation with here, some of what we're looking at kind of moving forward. And then, as I mentioned here in this final, convening authority to bring parties together, it only goes so far. producers and utilities aren't making contracts or they don't see the gas supplies, there's not a lot of authority in our kind of quiver to move that to the next step. But we do think that, and I know you've seen this, and we won't spend too much time on, because I don't want to make it sound like, hey, everything's great. We don't think everything's great. The tone of this is we have some concerns. But it also is important to recognize that the efforts that we've been undertaking, that others have been undertaking, have started to have a pretty significant impact. And, you know, as noted here, 2 years ago, you could see the conventional wisdom was that there wasn't a lot of opportunity here. And we have seen a whole host of old players, new players investing. You know, the number for 2012, we're kind of ballpark figure, almost, you know, pushing $500 million in terms of spending. Two very highly successful lease sales. Our 2011 lease sale is probably our second most successful lease sale in history. And again, that was out. We were out pitching this to a lot of different companies, trying to get them to come up here and do what we think is the number one most important thing, is to drill more wells and invest more money. And that's happening. Maybe it's not happening in time, but it's certainly happening relative to where we were 2 years ago. So if you look at some of these numbers, the rig number in particular is impressive, where we are in 2012, including the jackup, two jackup rigs, which I'm told that's never happened in the inlet's history. I might be wrong in that. This point that came out earlier on companies, particularly Apache, shooting 3D seismic, we've never had that kind of program with that kind of technology done. That has enormous opportunities for the state and other potential explorers. The gas storage, as we mentioned, is online. We are offering attractive prices, lower to obviously Henry Hub prices in the lower 48. And this is something else that I did want to mention. Again, Bill Barron, AOGCC, even the Coast Guard. There's a lot of new players in the inlet. You take a look at that next slide. And very varying degrees of capital balance sheets, expertise. So a lot of what we've been doing also is being quite vigilant. The last thing in the world we want to have happen is some kind of accident that kind of stops what we think is a Cook Inlet renaissance, because there was an operation that causes harm to people or the environment. So that regulatory oversight component is something that we're also busy with. But again, you look at this last slide, diversity of players. This is an important topic, that second bullet, oil versus gas. I've talked to there's conventionalism. Hey, certain company, I'll just name it, Apache's only looking for oil. Well, that's not what they tell me. If they do a 3D seismic program and find significant volumes of gas that they can sell at a commercial price where they make money, they'll certainly be interested in that. And the top guy in Apache is a Alaskan, you know, who I sure has a lot of the state's interest. So that's something I did want to mention here, because a lot of people think, well, that's big investment, but they're only doing it for oil. Same with Hillcorp. I don't think that's the case. But it needs to be attractive. And mentioned spending new capital. Certainly jobs are being created, which is important. And we are very cognizant of the fact that trying to help incentivize this exploration and drilling and investment boom, I think there's no other way to talk about it, into production. And that's going to be really important. And that's, we're working that as well. So you've seen these articles, you know, National Press about a year and a half ago, Wall Street Journal had a huge article on Cook Inlet. That's on the right side. And then Petroleum News had a very, very long article just last week on what's going on in Cook Inlet. So we're not saying we're there yet, but compared to where we were 2 years ago, there's some cause for optimism, but we're not trying to whistle past the graveyard either here. But we're also not saying the sky's falling down. It's kind of a combination. So when we look at kind of moving forward, I think the most important thing we're going to do is focus on our what we've been doing, which is trying to get more wells drilled and more investment, redouble those efforts, encourage the behind-the-pipe production, and continue to reach out to all the parties to look at different ways to incentivize more Cook Inlet production. This issue of information modernization is also really important. Other additional efforts that we're hearing from, and maybe this committee is hearing from, not saying we're endorsing them right now, but just for your information, infrastructure on the west side of Cook Inlet, a lot of the production companies and explorers see as critical. More gas storage, we certainly think, could have some positive impacts with regard to energy security. There's been talk, again, we're hearing this, maybe you're hearing it, we have not endorsed it, but, you know, additional incentives on investment or tax areas. But Senator Dyson, this point on the right side of your of this slide really goes to your point there on this idea of keeping an eye on the, you know, industrial size markets. So you have the attractiveness of a basin. That, of course, the number one thing from our perspective is to address the energy needs of Alaskans, but also have a broader ability for market certainty in large volumes where we continue to attract more investors. And it's a balance, and we're trying to work that. And some of these, you know, might get, it's complicated, because if you talk about LNG facilities being available, while at the same time you're talking about shortages of contracted gas, it can be a very, very different message. But having a view of those things for the longer-term health of the basin is really important. And I think one of the things that in all of our meetings that we've, there's not a lot, with this many stakeholders, there's not always the ability to get consensus is somewhat challenging. But one area where I think there's a lot of consensus, I think maybe unanimity, is getting more gas and having more gas come from Cook Inlet is the way everybody wants this to go. Not saying it's going to happen, but the utilities included. So the other thing that we've mentioned here, again, this goes a little bit more, not directly in our area, but, you know, encourage redundancy and kind of belt and suspenders options for energy security, kind of your point on parallel paths. Ready to meet potential near-term and immediate-term shortfalls. You know, the governor's laid out a comprehensive, and AEA and ADA are looking at that. North Slope trucking, particularly focused on the interior. But does that have potential for peak volumes at a certain point or other? Yeah, we think it has that potential. And then the governor's talked about, we look at importing gas as a last resort. Nobody's saying no to it. It goes to, again, our focus, like everybody else's, is on security. But there are some concerns when you, it depends on how you define that. We've talked about it as a last resort, particularly large volume, long-term contracts of LNG or CNG. You know, one of the utilities got a DOE permission to import 50 BCF of gas for 2 years. It's a lot of gas. What does that kind of do to the Cook Inlet Renaissance, jobs, employment for the local workforce? And this one, you know, I can reference it, that last bullet, because I talked about it on Friday, but from a broader strategic perspective, we view, for the big line, an LNG project, we're in serious competition globally. One of our biggest competitors, in my view, is the Western Canada projects, Kitimat, Prince Rupert. We have certainly let the Asian countries know that the only place right now in North America that's ever exported LNG to Asia is Alaska. The Canadians love to tout how they're going to be the savior of Asia. When I've had the opportunity to talk to potential customers, I remind them very frequently that the Canadians haven't exported one molecule of gas anywhere in the form of LNG or CNG. So we want to be given those projects the market and global credibility to compete with us by sending it here. I'm not so sure that is necessarily in the strategic interest of the state. So these are things. We're not saying no, but we're letting this committee know some of the reasons we have concerns that they've been, the governor's voiced them. But there is kind of a hierarchy in terms of short-term versus long-term. Are you doing something that has capacity just for peak emergency needs versus a 20-year CNG contract with huge volumes? Those are highly different scenarios and would have enormously different implications for the state, and it's in everybody's interest to keep a close eye on those. So, but we think it's important, and I'll touch on this last point, to learn from history, and kind of Joe was talking about it earlier, but have a sense of what the implications of what we're doing are in the immediate term might be with regard to longer term ramifications. Do you want to just talk to this last slide?
So, again, Joe Balash here, and Madam Chair, direct the committee's attention to this slide on the history of APL5. It was a contract between Marathon and NSTAR that would have been a full requirements contract meeting all of NSTAR's needs through 2016. Now, full requirements, what does that mean? It means that Marathon would have been responsible for all of the swings that you see summer to winter. They would have met all of NSTAR's needs through the course of each and every year, all the way through 2016, and had a linkage to Henry Hub pricing, which at the time, in that this contract was being reviewed by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska in 2005, was a little bit of an increase over what Alaskans were accustomed to paying. I think that'll be worth revisiting here in a second. At the end of the day, the commission in its docket took testimony, heard from multiple parties. The public advocate in the Department of Law opposed the contract. Some of the other utilities opposed the contract as well. They were concerned that it was going to set a precedent for their pricing. And in the end, the commission rejected the proposal. Now, what was especially damaging was that they just rejected the proposal. They didn't say why. They didn't say what would be acceptable. And there was a devastating effect in the marketplace. It sent a chill through the industry and the inlet that we, frankly, haven't recovered from. Drilling dropped dramatically that year. It very likely was the beginning of the end of Marathon's presence in Alaska. Now, there probably were also knock-on effects that implicated and impacted the LNG facility and long-term plans there. One of the things that came up shortly after this decision by the RCA was an application by the co-owners at the time, Marathon and ConocoPhillips, to extend the export license necessary to operate the facility. Utilities and the state, through the Public Advocate's Office, opposed the license being extended, and so that led to a short-term approach for managing the issues at play with regard to local energy security. The objection of all the parties that were opposing at the time had to do with whether or not local needs could be met or would be met. Now imagine, had APL5 been approved with all of NSTAR's needs, full requirements through 2016 under contract, what the dynamic would have been then in 2007 when this new export license application was being reviewed by the DOE. The arguments and the considerations would have been drastically different. And so the setback on APL 5 very likely had an impact on the way this DOE export issue unfolded. And I think we can also take a look back at that particular instance from a regulatory perspective and ask, gee, good intentions, but did they get it right? Well, I'm fairly certain that we would all be more than happy to be paying Henry Hub pricing for South Central Energy right now. There's a start. And I think it underscores a certain danger when our regulatory bodies try to second-guess the market and decisions that are being made by the folks who actually have the capital at risk. Fundamentally, I think what it also underscores is a point that we've been trying to make without being too positive about it, and that is simply, we're not out of gas. Marathon would not have put its corporate reputation and balance sheet on the line if they didn't think there were sufficient reserves to meet all of the requirements of NSTAR through 2016 if it wasn't there. I fundamentally find it hard to believe that that they would have taken that kind of action recklessly. And so they probably had a different expectation for where Henry Hub pricing would be today, granted. But with regard to the fundamental question of is the gas there, you know, it's an indicator, and one that, you know, with that opportunity lost, we're in a dramatically different position today as a state, as a community, and are having to rethink how we approach all of these issues as a consequence. So with the curtailment of the LNG plant and operation, moving to a seasonal-only approach in the latter years, the signal to explorationists was changed. Nobody's going to drill for a lot of gas if they can't sell a lot of gas. And, you know, where we are today is a shrinking market that has continually gotten smaller over the course of the last 6 years and appears to be in danger of getting even smaller if some of these import options are done on a long-term contractual basis. And whatever interest there is left in finding and developing gas here locally in the basin could be snuffed out. So the hindsight on this is dramatic, but we can't change what happened. But if we can draw on some of these lessons here and identify how to learn from them and move forward with the decisions we have to make now, we can, I think, make wiser decisions.
Question, Mr. Balesh. The LNG license at the export facility expires in about 2 months.
Madam Chair, that is correct. There are basically two components of that license. One is a volume component. One is a temporal or time component. And it is the time that is about to run out. There are still at least another season worth of volumes available under the license that was last authorized.
Thank you. Last slide.
So, yes. So, Madam Chair, just summing up, we've seen positive developments in 2012. Concerns remain. You know, one of the themes here has been basin-wide, as Paul was talking about, we think there's significant volumes, but the concerns that the utilities are raising about deliverability, cold days in February, these are also very valid concerns. So what we have not wanted to do was say these are not valid. We think they're valid. We've been working closely with them. Again, some of these are issues that relate to timing. We're certainly going to continue what we've been doing with regard to getting out to different companies, different producers, and trying to continue the trend of more investment, more drilling, and hopefully soon more production. But and everybody, again, I think, believes that's the most important area where we can focus on. But, and it goes to Senator Michikis' statement, I do think we must be prepared on the security, energy security situation, to react to and be ready for a numerous scenarios, with energy security as the number one goal. But always keeping in mind, I think this last example, that's why we put the slide in, on what the long-term implications of what we're doing or what others are doing, they need to be thoroughly examined, because we want the jobs here, we want the continued investment here, we want the continued exploration and hopefully production here, and it's really important to keep those in mind, even though we are looking at some near-term concerns. And then finally, it sounds a little, I guess it's a good way to end the presentation, but it really is important to have all the different parties working together. We've been trying to get together very regularly with literally all the different players. The governor has as well. And having that exchange of ideas, good ideas, letting everybody else know what they're working on, looking at ways for redundancy, and having kind of mutual support in those efforts, we think is important. We'll continue to play the role we've been playing on that, particularly in the last half year.
Very good. Members of the committee, any other questions for the commissioner and his team? Senator Dyson.
Yeah, Mr. Decker, as I remember the study that the utilities had done, they said something like there's got to be 17, 18 rigs working and drilling holes and even to stem the decline. Do you take issue with that?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I don't know the precise number, but I have also reviewed the PRA study. I agree with their conclusion that we need additional investment beyond what we've seen here in the last two or three years. And as the commissioner pointed out, I think primary reasons for that were that two of the main producers, Marathon and Chevron, knew that they were going to be out of the basin and didn't have any reason to sign up for, you know, delivering gas that they weren't going to be selling. So, but directionally, yes, I agree that we need significantly additional rate of drilling in the basin.
Senator Bishop.
Just one observation. It doesn't appear to be a lack of gas in the inlet, correct? Is that what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that would be our take on that as well.
It seems to be lack of an anchor tenant for somewhere for the gas to go.
Through the chair, the commissioner just made the point. It's a question of contracted gas.
The one issue, the immediate issue, is the contracted gas. And when the utilities talk about that, that's a legitimate. So in some ways, we're not saying that that is not a concern. As Paul mentioned at the outset, our area of focus has been trying to focus on the broader management of the resource and get what we think is significant gas to be able to be contracted through more drilling and through more investment. So I don't think we're disagreeing. We're just kind of coming at it. You don't want DNR kind of calling the producers and utilities together saying, here, go make a deal, right? That's not our role. What we've been trying to do is get the investment in the drilling, and you see the rig numbers have been going up substantially, to get it so there is contracted gas available for the utilities to make a deal for security supply. But the anchor tenant issue goes to a longer-term attractiveness of the basin, which we think is enormously important.
And if I may just add, the idea of storage serves that same role, really, as a reliable place to sell your gas to year-round. Very, very important.
Very good. Further questions? Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Bailash, Mr. Decker, thank you. Very good. We're going to be closing the meeting now. We went a bit over time, but this is an important topic, and so I don't want to shortchange the information. Tomorrow at noon and also Wednesday at noon, the Pacific Northwest Economic Region is here in Juneau. These folks are an organization that brings together Canadian and U.S. West Coast interests, and so we've got some Canadian officials here. They would be really valuable for, I think, for legislators to talk with, some of from British Columbia. So that would be good. On Wednesday, our meeting will have the Rail Belt utility representatives here talking about their view of the gas shortage. And then we're also going to hear Senate Bill 29. So this meeting will, on Wednesday, will definitely extend to 6 p.m. So at this time, we'll go ahead and adjourn. The time is 5:10 p.m.